This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Hockey News Podcast. It's Matt Larkin here with Ken Campbell and Ryan Kennedy. And it's kind of a slow news week because, you know, we're in early November. It's kind of the equivalent of, I don't know, August in a regular NHL calendar. So it's a perfect time to field some questions. We get so many good ones. We always have trouble getting to all of them. So I love doing these all mailbag editions. We're doing another one. We're just going to launch right into it, fellas. I hope you're ready. And we're going to kick it off with a question from James. James wants to know about the Dallas Stars. He says, hey, guys, the Stars seem like a team in flux who had a lot of success last year, but did so with many aging players. Of course, lots of young talent, too, with Miro Heiskanen and company. If you were Jim Neal, how would you handle the next few years in Dallas? Thank you. So let's start it off with Mr. Kennedy, Ryan. In honor of the Democrats winning, we'll go with Kennedy.
There you go. I feel that Dallas is going to get into a transition mode fairly quickly. I think, you know, next season, you don't have a lot of flexibility. I think you just kind of go for it again. You don't do anything big at the deadline, but you see what you can do with a healthy Sagan, a healthy Ben Bishop, a healthy Jamie Benn, and you just don't take on any more big contracts at this point, because in the next couple of years, you're going to want to transition to a team that is focused around Miro Heiskanen. Your starting goalie is probably going to be Jake Oettinger. You have Rupi Hintz, Dennis Gurianov. You have Ty Dellandrea coming up. So eventually you're going to shed some contracts. You're going to shed Joe Pavelski. You're going to shed Alexander Radulov. You might get to the point where you have to think about, do we re-sign John Klingberg or do we let him walk as a free agent? And you're also going to have to think, do we want to keep Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin for the duration of their contracts, which are big ticket contracts and long-term? Those are the conversations Jim Neal's going to have, not this year, but certainly the year after.
Yeah, they're tied to their goaltending for the next 3 years, unless Khudobin gets taken by Seattle. I'm with you, Ryan. I think this is a team you can either sit in the mushy middle and watch your decline, or you can go for it and then sort of clean up the mess after. I would be more inclined for them to go for it and clean up the mess after, because you don't get this close. You just don't get this close very often. I don't know if the Dallas Stars will get this close again, but I think they've kind of made their bed. They've made it with a lot of veteran guys. They do have some decent youth. Their youth in the NHL is very good. Their youth outside the NHL is probably just okay, I would say. So it's not like, you know, they've got this stockpile of great young players that's on the way to replace these guys. If I'm Jim Neal and the Dallas Stars, I would keep plowing ahead, going for it for the next couple of years, and then deal with the mess that comes with that. Jim's a scouting guy. He's got a great scouting background. He's got some very good people working for him. You know, Joe McDonnell's a terrific guy to find talent. So you beat the bushes, try and find some guys in the late Ryan rounds, try and find some free agents. But I think you have to keep the pedal to the metal in Dallas without question.
Yeah, I think you guys are right, because we know this is an old team, especially at forward, especially in net. The one thing I'm wondering, so, you know, if you are in win now mode, isn't going to be enough. I don't know if it's enough to stay with status quo. So I do think if you're Jim Neal, you have to look at one major move. And I think that major move is to trade John Klingberg. He's got 2 years left on his deal. His contract's really attractive. He's a right-handed shot. He has no restrictions on movement of any kind on his contract. You have Miro Heiskanen to build around. You still have Esa Lindell for your shutdown role. You have Thomas Harley coming up, which is the best prospect on the team, who I think could make the team this year and is a good puck mover. And I think the only way at this point to bring in the forward help you need is via trade. Because like you said, Ken, the pipeline is it's kind of meh. The top prospect is Ty Dellandrea. In Future Watch, our scouting panel ranked him 43rd overall out of all NHL prospects. You know, good. And, you know, comes from he's a good story from what he went through in the OHL and some bad teams to get to where he is now. But he's not an A-grade prospect, right? He's probably an A-minus or a B-plus grade prospect. If you're going to get that help and land a Markkanen, I think Patrick Laine is the guy I'd want to go for if I was Dallas, with all the Finns on the team. And what does Winnipeg need? A right-handed shot who can move the puck? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe a little fit there, or at least starting point for a trade. That's something I would want to pursue if I were Jim Neal, but, you know, I'm not Jim Neal. He's way better than me. I'm just saying, this is just an idea. But I do think, all seriousness, I think that you have to consider trading Klingberg. If you're all in, you may as well keep it going and make one more bold move to try and get over the hump. The next question we've got comes from Beast. Beast of X-Men fame. And Beast wants to know, with all the talk about a Canadian division, is there any idea what the other three would look like? Are the playoffs likely top four in each division? Would there be no true conferences and hence no Wales or Campbell Trophy winners? I did ask Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly this morning about this based on your question, Beast. And he said that they want to say they're making an announcement soon, but they still have not decided anything other than, you know, probably the Canadian teams. So we still don't officially know. I can speculate that I think you have to look at time zones as your dividing lines, especially. So you're going to have, you know, all your Pacific teams, maybe some Mountain Time Zone teams put over there. And then you're going to have a lot of Central teams. And I think you're going to take if you look at where the Central Division teams are, a lot of them are fairly south. So, you know, Nashville, Dallas, and then you can make a division with some of those teams and some of the southeastern American teams like, you know, Florida, Tampa Bay. And then you've got teams in the Northeast, you know, teams like Boston, New York, New Jersey, et cetera, that maybe could be in a division as well. That's my prediction. But as of, you know, 10 minutes ago, which is when I got the reply to the email, there's still nothing decided. But maybe you guys know more than I do. So let's hear what you have to say about it. Kenny.
Well, we don't know, first of all, even what the season is going to look like. If it's all played in bubbles, then it doesn't really matter, right? You're going to have the Canadian division, and then you're going to have all the American teams playing one another. It's still kind of a hybrid right now, I think, of, you know, starting with bubbles and then maybe moving to these kind of, you know, three games in a week series between two teams. So the way I see it is, you know, you've got the Canadian division, and then if you're going to do it, like, you could leave the Metropolitan division intact and just go with that and then spread the other teams around. But the way I see it is you probably have one division of Anaheim, LA, San Jose, Arizona, Vegas, Colorado, Dallas, and Minnesota. And then you have another division, like you said, Matt, with this central teams, Chicago, St. Louis, Nashville, Columbus. Well, then you put in Columbus, Florida, Carolina, Detroit, Tampa Bay. And then you probably go with all the, you know, with a couple of additions to the Metropolitan guys, Rangers, Islanders, Jersey, Washington, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Boston, Buffalo. That's sort of the way I would see it clustering. But as you said, I mean, there's nothing really, it's kind of a moot point right now because we don't even know what the season's going to look like at this point.
Yeah, I don't really have too much to add to that. I think, you know, you guys made some very valid points and it is really up in the air, but with the bubbles, you know, that obviously mitigates travel a little bit because you're already in a spot for quite a while. I mean, the most interesting is the Canadian division simply because of the geography, but I think we're going to get that in another question later on.
That's right. And for the record, it still angers me that in the regular NHL alignment, the Metropolitan Division has like five teams that are on the Atlantic Ocean and the Atlantic Division has like mostly inland teams. Just switch the names. Are you kidding me? Like, what? Come on. Next question is from Matthew Boehringer. And Matthew Boehringer wants to know, I love this question, what prospect that was previously labeled as a bust could have a breakout year and turn his career around this season? We'll go with Mr. Prospect Ryan Kennedy first bids on this question.
I'm going to go with a player that was a favorite of mine during his draft year that hasn't made an impact yet, and that's Christian Vesalainen, the Winnipeg Jets prospect. Right, he's bounced around a lot of teams and a lot of leagues in Europe, you know, played in the AHL last year. But right now he's on loan to HPK in Finland, 5 points in his first three games. So it looks like he's on track. You know, he's a big dude, always had a lot of scoring potential. It's just a matter of, you know, turning those, that potential into actual numbers. And it feels like he's getting there now. You know, he was a first round pick in 2017. So most of his draft mates have already made an impact. But I feel like it's sort of the time, you know, because these more sort of like power forwardy guys, they tend to take a little bit longer to find their groove at the pro level. I feel like Vesalainen is getting to that point. And, you know, Matt, you've been sort of banging the drum about a potential Patrick Laine trade. if Winnipeg was to make that move, they would obviously have a top six wing open, assuming they trade for a defenseman. Vesalainen obviously would benefit from that move.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Jesse Puljujärvi, the Edmonton Oilers' highly touted number four pick from the 2016 draft. A guy who, you know, I mean, really, really struggled at the NHL level, played in the minors, you know, left, went back to Finland. You know, it really looked like the, you know, the whole sort of relationship between him and the Oilers was down the crapper. And now they've got him back. And, you know, I mean, I think this is where a guy like Ken Holland, I think his patience, his experience, his whole demeanor with players, you know, the fact that it's a clean slate with him now in Edmonton, I'm hoping that brings out the best in Puljujärvi. You know, he's a guy who's really struggled and a guy who, you know, I mean, in his draft year was right there with, you know, with the best prospects in that draft. And I really hope that he's a guy that can come in this year, you know, have an impact, not a huge, enormous, like I'm not looking for a 40 goal a year, but a guy who, you know, you'll see some progress from, you'll some positive progress that he can build upon and then take off from there.
Good. Flag on the play. As I told you guys, my pick was also Jesse Puljujärvi, but Ken did not get the memo.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't get the memo.
I picked Puljujärvi as well, because I actually talked to Ken Holland about it the day he was signed and what Holland was explaining. So to add to that, because I couldn't think of another one off the top of my head. Holland saw it as a blank slate because it was an old regime that drafted Puljujärvi, Peter Shirelli. So he saw it as a chance to mend fences. And Puljujärvi and his agent and Dave Tippett and Ken Holland had a bunch of Zooms over the summer, kind of getting reacquainted with each other. And then they established a good relationship, and now they're coming in. They're going to give Puljujärvi every chance to earn his way up the lineup. And, you know, Kyle Yamamoto is locked into one of the top two right winger spots now, especially with that chemistry with Leon Draisaitl. But otherwise, you know, Zach Cashin, guys like that, I think those are not insurmountable pieces to climb past if Puljujärvi shows a lot in camp. So like the ceiling is still really high. And I did some math at the time. It's something like Puljujärvi is still younger than, I think it was like 69% or 78%. It's like roughly 2/3 of the players that played in the NHL this season were older than Puljujärvi. So it kind of gives you perspective of how young he still is, right? Or maybe it was even this rookies. Like he's still younger than most of the rookies that played in the last year. So there's still time for him. And, you know, the opportunity is going to be there this year, I think. Next question. Joe with the Vikings. This is another one I love. Hot takes on surprise big names that might get exposed in the Seattle draft. Well, I was going to give Ken the floor to this one, but I'm afraid he's going to take mine again. So I'm going to go first.
No, I'm not taking it. I remember that one.
All right, you go first, Ken.
Okay, I'm going to go PK Subban. He'll have 1 year left on his deal at $9 million. I can see one of those cases where, you know, the New Jersey Devils would say to Seattle, well, if you take PK, then we'll sweeten the pot with a second round pick or, you know, a prospect of some sort, some description. So, yeah, I can see PK being a big name that would be exposed and maybe even taken.
Yeah, I like that one, too, because, I mean, Subban would be such a tremendous face for a new franchise. You know, you get him in all the press conferences. That'd be fantastic for the Kraken. I'm going to go with another big ticket guy, Ryan Johansson in Nashville. Now, his contract is a little more onerous than Subban's because Johansson's runs for another 4 years after they get him, and it's $8 million. But again, you know, Seattle, they're starting with a blank slate. They're going to have tons of cap room. And if Nashville tosses in a draft pick or an asset, then at least, you know, for Seattle, you're like, okay, well, we've got sort of a 1B or a number two center that can help us right away. And you know, we get some assets in return. And obviously for Nashville, they get a ton of cap space back. So it definitely works for them. And he does not have any no trade clause, no move clauses on his contract. So they could certainly do it if they wanted to.
A great pick, and where did he play his junior hockey? Portland, right? So Portland Winterhawk, geographically, there's a connection there for anyone that was a Winterhawks fan, because that would be pretty close. In my pick, there's a similar connection to where he played junior, Tri-City Americans in Washington State, goaltender Carey Price. This one's going to need some explaining. But, hey, Joe with the Vikings asked for a hot take, so I'm going with a hot take here. And projecting out, let's say the Habs are not as far along as they thought they were going to be this year. So a year passes and they don't make the playoffs. You've got Caden Primo, who's pretty close to being an NHL-ready goalie. He's one of the best prospects in the game. You've still got Jake Allen, who's supposed to be the expansion bait. But eventually you're going to need to give Caden Primo reps because developmentally he can't really do much more. He's pretty close to being ready. So imagine if you realize that Primo's NHL-ready, you have a chance to free up more than $10 million in cap space. You can send Carey Price out west where he's originally from. BC guy, and also where he played in the state where he played his junior hockey, and would be a huge prestige ad for a brand new franchise to draw bums to seats. Well, if they're allowed in seats by then. So I could see it from both teams' standpoints. And if you're Montreal, it's like you still have a good prospect coming up, and you could free up a lot of money to do something pretty exciting with a team that's getting younger and really on the rise. So again, it's a hot take. He didn't ask for a cold take. So Carey Price is the hot take. Next question is from Brandon Gallarneau. And Brandon wants to Gallarneau. I suck.
Noise.
Everyone talks about Ray Bourque and how long it took for him to win his cup. And how Alex Ovechkin finally got his. And when Jumbo get his, Joe Thornton. How come nobody ever talks about Dave Vanderchuk, who, of course, won, I think it was more than 20 years, if I'm not mistaken, and finished his career with a cup in Tampa Bay. So why do you think that is? We'll start with you, Ryan.
I think it's because Dave Vanderchuk's career is, we look back on it as being prolific because of the amount of time he played. He was never the best guy in the league. Like Ray Bourque, when you watched him while he plays, like, that guy is a first ballot Hall of Famer. And like with Ovechkin, that guy's a first ballot Hall of Famer. With Vanderchuk, he put up great numbers and, he hit 50 goals. But it was sort of, his legacy will be that he was very good for a long, long period of time. So, culminating his career with a Stanley Cup was great, but it wasn't the same as, say, Teemu Selänne, where everybody wanted Selänne to get a cup. I think, if you were a fan of Dave Vanderchuk, sure, you wanted him to win a cup, but it didn't have the same resonance at the time. We it's almost like we look back on Dave Vanderchuk's career as being great, but we didn't necessarily see it at the time.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer this question any other way than to just say it's because it's Dave Vanderchuk. And the other guys are Alex Ovechkin, Ray Bourque, and Joe Thornton.
Yeah.
It's the difference in this league between being a star and a superstar. Dave Vanderchuk was a star. Dave Vanderchuk was an NHL star, no question about it. He was not a superstar. Ray Bourque was a superstar. Alex Ovechkin is a superstar. Joe Thornton is and was a superstar. Mm-hmm. Dave Vanderchuk was a very good player. He was a very good player. He wasn't a great player. He was a very good player. And he got a lot of points on the power play, and he was, scored a lot of goals, he is what he is. He was a very good player. He wasn't a great player. No disrespect to Dave Vanderchuk, but he doesn't belong in the same sentence with those guys. That's why. He just doesn't.
Yeah, good. I agree with you guys. Good answers. And just for perspective, Dave Vanderchuk was never a first or second team All-Star once in his career, never received a single MVP vote in any season. Ray Bourque was a 19-time first or second team All-Star, 13-time first team All-Star, most all time. Joe Thornton was an MVP scoring champion. So I agree. It's just a matter of being in a different league. Even Jerome Iginla was a scoring champion, won the Rocket Richard twice. So, again, different level. Vanderchuk never led the league in goals. He scored a lot of goals in the highest scoring era of hockey history, right? The mid to late 80s, early 90s. So I'm with you guys. Next question is from Phil's hockey page. Phil, are you a competitor? Come at us, Phil. Phil says, if a Canadian division is put together for next season and is successful, could it stay for the long term? My inclination is definitely not. Just the travel from east to west, traveling that frequently would kind of wreak havoc because Canada's coastline, it's the biggest coastline in the world. It's just like traveling from Toronto to Vancouver is like almost like going to England. It's not quite that far, but it's close. And it would be bad for business because, you know, American markets wouldn't get to see Connor McDavid as much, or Austin Matthews, or Elias Pettersson, Quinn Hughes, and so on. So that's where I stand. What about you, Kenny?
Well, they just put a team in Seattle. I mean, and part of that was so that Vancouver wouldn't have to go all over Hell's Half Acre to get to their to some of their games. No, I don't see this. I think if it was something that they were going to do, they would have done it already. The travel would actually be deadly, probably, in a lot of ways. And I just think that you don't have to sell hockey in Canada. I mean, you know, you don't need to juice up, you know, hockey in Canada by having a all Canadian division. You know, you've already got the fan base here. You've already got the markets that are, you know, going to sell out regardless, that are going to get high TV numbers regardless of, you know, of who they're playing and when they're playing and that sort of thing. I don't see it from a business point of view. I just don't see it. I think it would almost create like, it would almost be like there'd be like two solitudes almost, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it would be like really like, I just would get a real tribal sort of feeling. And also, I mean, if when you spread around the Canadian teams, you got a better chance of more Canadian teams going further in the playoffs, right? You know, I mean, if you put together a Canadian division, you're guaranteed four Canadian teams every year are not going to be in the playoffs. Right. And, you know, now that I run that through my head, that's probably the best reason right there is, you know, you're freezing out prop three or four Canadian teams right off the get-go out of the playoffs. And then, you know, a couple of them are going to be out in the first round. So, I mean, that's probably as good a reason as any.
For sure. Sportsnet would be like, no, please, the reigning.
Yeah, they paid like $5 billion for those rights. So yeah, they probably would have something to say about that.
Yeah. Another thing to consider too is in terms of TV ratings is the time zones. You know, if you're Toronto and Montreal, you don't necessarily want your fans having to wait until 9:30, 10:30 to watch half of their road games. And similarly, if you're in Vancouver, you don't want, you know, a bunch of your road games, or half of them, if you consider Ottawa as well, you don't want them having 4:30 starts because people are still at work at that point out in Vancouver. So in terms of ratings, I think you would take a hit because you're just pulling people in different directions and none of them are very convenient. You want those 7:30 start times local as much as you can.
Yeah, very good points. So for the next question, I've got to give credit to this guy named Kyle Congdon. His question is five rule changes you'd make big or small. So that implies he's asking for 15 rule changes in one podcast, back to back to back to back to back. So very ambitious by Kyle Congdon. Kyle King Congdon is more like it. And he has another question coming up that I didn't notice was also him. So he got two questions back to back. One of them involved us naming 15 rule changes on the spot. So I'm going to tweak it, Kyle. I like the ambition. I like the moxie. I'm going to say we're going to give you one rule change each just for the sake of the podcast not being 19 hours. So mine's going to be you take offsides and you give them the heave-ho. What is the point of having offsides? If you're cherry-picking, who cares? That's the gamble you're willing to take. If you're going to give up another chance the other way, well, it's risk reward. There's nothing wrong with that. It leads to more chances. There'd be fewer whistles. The games would be faster. You'd have fewer goals called back. I cannot think of a reason to keep offside. It's never going to happen because it's such a sacred rule, but I don't see the purpose of having offsides. All they do is make the game less fun and lower scoring and cause more arguments and more hand wringing and whistles and reviews. Blah, blah. It's nothing but bad. So to hell with offsides. Get out of here, offsides. Ken, what do you got?
Well, what do you guys think I would say?
Fighting.
Yeah, okay. I would penalize fighting with a game misconduct, and I would you know, enact suspensions for more than one fight and for instigating and for doing it in the last 5 minutes. I don't think that's going to happen, sadly. Ever. The one sort of off the wall one that I've never been able to understand is why teams get to ice the puck when they're killing a penalty. Like I've never been able to figure that out. I've never been able to have anybody ever explain it to me. I don't know why. I mean, you're being penalized. why are they giving an out to a team that's being penalized? So I can see it going one of two ways. Either you just say you're called for icing if you ice the puck on a penalty, Or you get, say, four icings a period without punity. So even if you're 5-on-5, you dump the puck down, you can do that four times in a period without being called icing. And after that, you get called every single time. You know, something like that. But I've never been able to understand why that's the case. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm, fair play. I'm going to go the opposite direction of Ken on his first point and say, get rid of the instigator. Actions must have consequences when it comes to hits from behind and dodgy hits and things like that. The instigator makes things too complicated. Just get rid of it. Go back to the 1980s. You know, fighting's down anyways. You might as well make it a just proposition in my mind. And as Ken said, you're not going to get rid of fighting, so you might as well level the playing field. No more instigator. It's a failed rule.
Okay. I like it. I like the logic on both ends. So we got Kyle Congdon again. He's just going for it. Okay. And this one, we have to keep this question in, even though it's second from Kyle Condon, because I know it's a fun question. I know, Ryan, you were keen on answering this one. So I'm going to give you first dibs, which is home and away jerseys. Why can't both teams wear their dark, aside from matchups with, you know, Detroit and Chicago, where the teams have the same primary color? Why is that the case? So Ryan, you go first.
I know. I don't know why this isn't a rule. We have seen it in the college ranks a bit. I know, like, I've seen, you know, Minnesota and North Dakota play where Minnesota's been wearing their gold and North Dakota had green. You can certainly do it. I don't understand why they don't do it. I also don't understand why teams don't wear white jerseys at home anymore, because it's much more fun to see 29, 30 other road jerseys, you know, if you're a season ticket holder, than seeing your own team's dark jersey 41 games a year. So I don't understand. I think it can easily be done with the road jerseys. You know, if you're Carolina and you're playing Detroit, that you're going to have to switch. But, you know, I mean, if you're San Jose, for example, you can wear the same jersey all year if you wanted to. Nobody would, you know, get in the way. I think it's much more fun to see the dark colors. And like I said, you know, We've seen it at junior levels. Even I was watching the USHL this weekend, and Muskegon went with a gray jersey, and they were playing, I think it was Dubuque or somebody that, you know, like Dubuque wears red, so you can do gray versus red. That's no problem. I think they should do it. I don't know why they don't.
Okay, well, let's get a couple of things out of the way here first. First of all, it's a sweater, not a jersey. Ryan, it's a sweater. That's the end of the conversation.
It was a sweater.
You had your time to talk. This is like you're doing like Donald Trump. You're
in an ambush.
Oh, come on, man. It's a sweater, not a jersey, first of all. Secondly, I've covered this game for like 30 years now, and I can honestly say this issue's never crossed my mind ever. Not even once, ever. I don't know, because that's the way you do it. Like, okay, so if you've got two teams wearing darks and you turn on the TV and you look, how do you know which team's the home team? How do you know whose
logo at Center Ice?
How do you know? How do you know? You don't know. You have no idea. I don't know. To me, it's like, man, there's so many other things in hockey that need changing. Oh, my God. Like, this is like number 1 million on the list of things that need changing in the NHL, in my opinion.
That's fair. Yeah. I think I was trying to find if there was an official ruling, and I found some evidence. I couldn't find it in the CBA. Like, I didn't have time to dig through the whole thing, but I think there are some rules, like dress code rules, about contrasting colors being mandatory. And it's for, you know, TV, it's for the play-by-play, because they want, when you're looking, you know, you want to be able to see and quickly just almost subconsciously pick up who's on what team, and even for officials making calls, all that kind of stuff. And anything that requires like subtle, quick, almost subconscious vision is easier when the colors are really contrasting. So I think that's where it comes from originally. And I think also it dates back to black and white television too, because if back in the day, when before there was color, just if everyone was in dark jerseys, they all looked the same. So I think that's where it started, but.
And I can attest to that. That was the case.
Yeah, there was when a joke, I was a kid.
Back when they wore sweaters.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, next question is from Sutton. Now that we have Seattle, what is the NHL's next expansion team? And we, again, not relocation, we're talking expansion. So make sure you're thinking of that when you give your answer. We will start with Mr. Campbell on this one.
Houston, I guess. I don't see a lot of relocation happening. I mean, everybody talks about it, but it almost never happens. Like if it hasn't happened with Florida and Arizona yet, like, I mean, everything the league's gone through in both of those markets particularly with Arizona, like if they haven't moved them yet, they're not moving them. So I guess that leaves Houston, big TV market, you know, natural rivalry with Dallas. You know, probably checks off an awful lot of boxes, has an arena, although, you know, I mean, now that arena is starting to, you know, I mean, actually I'm thinking of Kansas City, but I don't think Houston has an arena actually that would accommodate hockey unless they play it where, in the basketball arena. But yeah, I mean, they've got an owner there. They've got somebody who wants NHL hockey, who probably, but I don't see expansion coming down the pike for a while, simply because first of all, it's going to be, well, Seattle was $650 million. You know, what's the next expansion going to be? You're going to have an arena. There's going to be a lot of costs associated with that. I don't see Quebec City being able to absorb that. So I don't see Quebec City being a landing place for an expansion team. I see it being maybe a relocation if there ever is one. But yeah, I would think Houston would be the next one.
Yeah, I would agree. Houston makes the most sense. And then Quebec City. But I don't see it for quite a while either, because you're 32 now. It's such a good round number, 4 divisions of 8. You know, if you ever want to switch it up, you could do 8 divisions of 4. Good as is, but Houston has all the elements, as Ken said, and you know, Quebec City, if the fee wasn't huge, they obviously have a very new arena, which is beautiful. I've covered games there, you know, prospect games there, and it's an amazing arena. It's certainly an NHL arena. Just a matter about the finances and the will of the NHL to go past 32 teams.
For sure, for sure. And I think corporate sponsorship is a problem for the NHL from their perspective when it comes to Quebec as well. I had Houston and Quebec down as relocation spots because of, I think they're both safety valves. Like Quebec's a safety valve if Florida or Ottawa has to fold, and Houston's a safety valve if Arizona has to fold, because Arizona's going to be moving to the Central. I had a new sleeper team that I went with for expansion, which is Milwaukee. I think Wisconsin's a big hockey state. And I know Milwaukee took a shot at it, like around the time that the Senators got a franchise in the early 90s. And they have a new arena built in 2018, the Preserve Forum, which is built to NHL specifications. So you have a hockey state that I think it's a market that already is familiar and enjoys the game. And you also have an arena that's brand new and NHL ready. So Milwaukee would be my sleeper expansion pick. We'll just do a couple more questions before we wrap it up and start the rapid fire game. 2 more. We'll do one from Joel. And Joel just wants to know, how does one get to work for the Hockey News? So, Ryan, you can start this one.
Practice, practice, practice.
That's my answer.
You know, I mean, a lot of us have gone different routes. You know, we've had a lot of former interns that have become staffers. We've had people come in freelance and sort of work their way up. But I mean, really, I find that, you know, especially these days, the most important thing is to find your niche within the hockey world and become an expert in that niche. And that makes you valuable, not only, you know, for a prospective employer, you know, at the Hockey News, but anywhere really in the hockey landscape, because I think that's where we're sort of at right now, is specialization within the hockey realm.
It's a weird question, because usually when people ask about my employment at the Hockey News, it's always like, how do you have a job? How do we get fired? What do we have to do to make you go away? So I'm not used to this kind of question, but I mean, I'm assuming that this person that's asking is a young person who is considering a career in journalism and hockey journalism. And I mean, I'll tell this person the same, and all the people the same thing I tell everyone is I think it's really important to find your voice. to really, like, don't be afraid to fail. Don't put yourself out there, you know, pitch story ideas, try to cover big events, go, you know, be there, make the contacts, you know, have your face out there, you know, I've found too that for me, a lot of the contacts that I made early in my career when guys were scouts or junior coaches or young players, not even in the NHL yet, when I developed a relationship with them, when they started to move up the ranks, you know, that they kind of kept me in mind and, you know, I developed them as really good sources and good go-to people for a lot of things too. So there's no real set formula, especially today and in today's sort of climate with media and everything. But I just think it's just a matter of I think the thing that you have to have most of all is passion. You have to have a huge passion for the game, and I think a lot of it will take care of itself from there.
Really good points, guys. And I would say another is just to don't push all your chips on to theoretical experience and just the specific educational side of the journalism. You got to do the practical side. You got to get your reps in. So it's like if you're in J school, don't just rely on your journalism degree, work for the student paper as well, because you need to get the practical experience of calling people and working on deadlines and feeling pressure and just getting those reps. So that way, when you're called into, or, you know, you have an opportunity to work for a real paper, if you've already done it for a long time, even at a student paper, the experience is still similar. So it doesn't feel like as rough of a transition. And I know, I remember seeing that for people who didn't work for a student paper and just did the actual program. Some of them had, it was a bigger mountain to climb just doing the everyday grind of pounding out stories. So that's one. And the other one is just, you know, it's kind of like what Ryan said about being a specialist. It's like, if you want to reach the highest level, the ironic path is to do the opposite and cover the lowest level. So it's like, if a kid walks in and says, hey, I want to write a column about the Leafs. And my answer is like, yeah, you know who else wants to write a column about the Leafs? Say it, everyone. Everybody wants to write a column about the Leafs. But you know, nobody's writing about, you know, the AHL. So become an authority on the AHL, and you're actually ironically going to get more notice because you're doing something that no one else is doing. You carve out your niche, and so it's like, go the opposite direction, and it's actually more likely to become a springboard. And the example I always use, I've mentioned this to her and that I think she's a great story, and I've used it. It's a writer named Haley Salvian at The Athletic. She's now the Ottawa Senators beat reporter, but before that she was like the authority on covering the women's game. When the CWHL shut down, she was on that story. No one else had the scoops that she had, so she was covering a smaller niche, and she had it. She became well known because she was the first and best and only one doing it, and then now here she is covering the NHL, right? So I think she's a great example of a success story. One more question, if we can handle it. I don't know if we have one. What's that?
If I could add something, if you got an opportunity to work for a junior hockey team, that's also a very good experience, and you're always going to be surrounded by people, and getting to know prospects is not a bad idea.
For sure. Yeah. Excellent idea. And so our final question, if we can do it, so this is from literally my dad, and he says he loves the mailbag edition, but his one critique is that we agree on too many things. So is there a topic that we cannot agree on? So I'll give you three topics to choose from, and we can debate one of them. Okay, one is hockey sweater versus jersey, because you guys are already feeling that. Two would be, who's the greatest goalie of all time? Because I know we don't necessarily agree on that one. And three is, does anyone want to fight with me over the fact that electric hand dryers are crap and have the lowest standard of excellence of any invention in the world? So you guys can choose one of those three topics.
Okay, am I first? Yeah, I'm not going to go the goalie one because I think you and I think the same guy.
Hashik,
yeah.
Okay.
No, I think Hashik.
What was the non-hand dryer one? What was the other one? Oh, sweaters versus jersey.
Jersey versus sweater.
How about this, Matt? Okay. How about this? Seinfeld is the most overrated show in the history of television. How about that?
Okay. So I think that
it's the Dave Andrechuk of shows. It's a good show. It's not a great show.
It's the Beatles of shows, or it's like the Doug Harvey of shows. It's so much has come as a result of it that people stop giving it credit. So it's like Doug Harvey walked so Bobby Orr could run, right? And Seinfeld walked so many other shows that came after could run. It was like the observational humor show, the cynical humor show. It pushed the boundaries of network TV with things that would be considered taboo on any other show. So I think people retroactively don't give Seinfeld enough credit now because they forget how big of a phenomenon it was while it was happening, which I think is exactly the same as the Beatles. People love to hate on the Beatles because they're so mainstream, but when the Beatles were debuting, they were doing things that no one else was doing. They've been imitated so much since that now they blend in and seem like they're facing the crowd.
Yeah, I would disagree with that too, because I feel the Beatles are super overrated because, I mean, the Dave Clark Five was doing the exact same thing. The Beatles were just a boy band when they began. I mean, like, if you look at what they were doing, they were the Backstreet Boys of the early 60s.
Eventually,
they went off in different directions because they had amazing producers that they worked with and they had all the time in the world. And there was only like two kinds of music back then. So they didn't have a lot of competition. But to me, and that's my ultimate hot take, is if the Beatles are your favorite band, it's like saying water is your favorite drink. It's like, yeah, things had to start from somewhere, but then we built upon them.
Yeah, and that's why I think the Beatles Seinfeld analogy, like the people on both sides of the debate, I think they're very similar.
The Seinfeld thing too, the thing that future shows learned from Seinfeld was it's really good to actually be funny.
Yeah,
that helps a lot too.
And so. Really telegraph that one.
I'm in the middle on that because Seinfeld definitely was like the buzziest show at the time, but they show reruns now and like they're not really funny anymore. They were funny at the time, but they don't stand the test of time.
For 3 years, Seinfeld was brilliant. It was brilliant. I thought it was one of the funniest shows I'd ever seen. And then all the people became a parody of themselves. They all became really predictable. And I don't know, self-absorbed, and I just hated it.
I think that's fair. I think it's middle was its peak for sure. Okay, it's time for the rapid fire game. I am up as the host. So Ryan, you're going to be answerer number one. Ken will be answerer number two, arbitrarily, all just right. So we don't talk over each other. Okay, are you guys ready?
Yes.
Are you ready for rapid fire? Okay. Ryan, who is the most overrated player of the salary cap era?
Overrated of the salary cap era? Ooh, that's a good one.
Wow.
Rapid fire.
I mean, is Ryan Johansson rated? I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be a good one.
Okay.
Sure. Ryan Johansson.
Matt Duchene.
I'll say Jonathan Quick. Two great playoff runs, very mediocre in the regular season. What is
two cups?
Exactly. Do you see what Martin Jones' numbers were in LA? Unbelievable. What happened to him after he left? What is the greatest sports movie of all time?
Slapshot.
Caddyshack.
And Steven says Miracle. I'm going to say Rocky. Because of the fact that he imitated and duplicated so many times since.
By other Rockies.
Yep. And another movie. What is the best hockey jersey or sweater number and why?
Ooh. I'm going to go with 7. Just because there's so many great players attached to it and it's just such a pure hockey number. I'll also, 3 would be after that.
Wow, 3. That's an underrated one. I mean, 19 right now seems to be the one that all the star players love. For me, it's 27 because Frank Mahovlich wore it for the Canadiens in 71, 72, and 73 before he jumped over the WHA. I couldn't believe he did that. And he was my favorite player, so I'll go 27. And I've always worn 27.
All right, Steven chimes in with number 83 for Rito Von Arx. Okay, Steven, thank you for that. 19 is my favorite, but I'm going to say the greatest is 99. I don't think any number in any sport is more synonymous with a single player than 99 is in hockey. So to me, that makes it singular, I guess, would be the word. Like if anyone else dares wear 99, it's always a joke when someone does it. Next one. Do you believe in ghosts?
Ooh.
No. It's rapid fire. No.
Yeah, I'm going to say no too. I can't. I don't know what to do with that one.
I'm going to say no in case the ghosts are watching. I don't want them to think that I believe. Which press box has the best food?
Ooh, that's a good one. Buffalo is up to their game lately. Boston's pretty good. And Chicago's pretty good as well.
Yeah, I've always said during the Stanley Cup final, when you're in Chicago, it's the equivalent of being at a 10-year-old's birthday party. Like, they got all these finger foods over here. They got build your own sundae over here and cakes here. And like, I'm looking around to see if there's a guy making balloon animals in the corner, like in Chicago. Chicago by far the best. However, the second one, just for one thing, is a Staples Center in LA for the chocolate covered popcorn. That, like, when LA went to the Stanley Cup final in 12 and 14, I think I gained about 30 pounds both times. That stuff for me is like, that chocolate covered popcorn was like, it seriously was my form of crack cocaine.
Yeah. My pick is Chicago, because they do like St. Louis style. They have toasted ravioli there when I was there last, and candy and all this good stuff. And I just was a pig when I was there. Are you a cat person or dog person?
Dog person. Cats are mean and they don't like to get wet, which is too much like me.
Yeah, cats are, I don't know if we can say the word, but like, cats are a-holes, right? Like,
yeah.
Pretty much. They're just a-holes.
They're jerks.
And they're jerks. Yeah, and my son just got a baby chihuahua about like 3 months ago, and this little thing is so hilarious and adorable. Yeah, I'm definitely a dog.
Yeah, Steven is, of course, all about cats. He tells Ken to shut up. So Steven sucks because cats suck. Cats are evil, and they just spontaneously turn on people. I always said, in the era of America's Funniest Home Videos, like, a cat attacks a child, and it's sent in by so-and-so. Second place is cat bites baby. If a dog does that, the dog's put down. Oh, cats, they stop. They're the devil. They're the crappiest animal on earth. Eat that, Steven. And I'm going to end on that note. Thank you for listening and watching. It was a lot of fun. We love doing the mailbag. Keep the good questions coming. Thank you, everybody.